Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello again. You're listening to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I am Hugh Wisencroft, and today, well, the Premier League has shown us an unusual trend. Do you think this is the most open season ever? And if only Mikel Arteta had a creative spark in his side. Have Arsenal now been given a reality check? A year after their biggest defeat in their history, Southampton are one of the Premier League's toughest opponents. We'll ask why. And after the Bolton boss Ian Evatt tells a young goalkeeper to man up, we'll ask what counts as a manager crossing the line. To help me through it all, Gregor Robertson, Alison Rudd and Matt Dickinson. Hello, guys. How are you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Nice to speak to you. I was looking at the Premier League table a little bit earlier on. Ominously, Alison, Liverpool are second at the moment for everyone else in the league. But if you look across the other sort of traditional big six, Chelsea are down in ninth. Arsenal are 10th, Spurs 11th, Manchester City 13th and Manchester United in 15th. And that, we feel, would buck a normal trend after five or six games. I'm certain at least two or three of those sides would be in the top six already. What do you think the difference is? Is it the most open season we've ever seen and why? Alison, I'll start with you.
Hard not to agree that it is the most open start to a season. And I think given that this weekend was relatively dull, it'd be interesting to see if we slowly start to get the sort of results and phases that we'd normally expect. But I don't think we should think we're that special, to be honest, because it's Europe-wide, this weirdness. I mean, Lille have been doing well rather than PSG. Leipzig have been doing well. I mean, Sassuolo, I mean, who the hell are they in Italy? And Rangers scoring wonder goals in Europe, as I wrote in the Sunday Times, scoring goals in Europe and topping the SPL. I mean, it's all about the weirdness of the world, isn't it? And how each of the big clubs, I think, have had less time to recover from having to finish off what was a relatively good season for them. So they've had less time with their players, have probably tried to micromanage the fact that they had less rest, so they've tried to incorporate that into training, and so they're not quite at it, perhaps. No crowds has a different effect, not only on each club and manager, but on each individual player, I suspect, and those teams that have probably brought in psychs and addressed it rather than trying to pretend it's not happening are probably doing better. There's a myriad reasons why I suspect it will settle down, and in fact it's starting to do so, as in I think Liverpool won the way champions win when they've got a few problems but their quality comes to the fore. It wasn't, Liverpool's victory was not very exciting, but they just do enough. That we'll probably start to see a few more of those sorts of results where just having the best players and the best manager when things aren't quite right, you get the result you probably would expect. But it's been astonishingly open. What I would just finally add is it's not open at the bottom, though. I think most pundits and writers predicted what the bottom five, six would look like, and that's what it looks like.
What, Man United in there?
Yeah, everyone didn't they?
Yeah, you might be right. No, I think Alison's right, really. I mean, you could go through every team and pick out the various kind of flaws and improvements and whatnot. But I think the broader picture is that this is just a kind of a very surreal beginning to the season. And I think, as I've said before, last season there was something about when the restart, it was a 6-week window, we got to finish it. this is it, it's beginning, and this is the new kind of reality for we don't know how long. And I think there's still quite a lot of adjustment going on to that. And I don't know, I think also would agree that we don't want to get too carried away. I mean, we thought last year that Leicester around, you know, until Christmas were possibly going to challenge Liverpool for the title, and then they finished fifth. They always, the kind of so-called big six always find a way to find, you know, to end up in and around those six places. So they have the money, they have the resources. If we get to January and they're still kind of lagging behind, they'll still have more money and resources. And I wouldn't get too carried away just yet, personally.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost the opposite of, I think, what we saw from the early matches of lockdown, because I think the removal of home advantage, I went to a few games then, and it sort of seemed that with the sort of sterile nature of stadium with no fans, that it was almost a matter of, well, you know, the team with the best players is going to win. They were sort of taking out a sort of I remember going to an Aston Villa Chelsea game, and you know, in a game where you'd normally think, well, at Villa Park, the fans will somehow lift their team, maybe force some kind of comeback. It actually turned out to be, yeah, the team with the better players just got the ball and passed around them. And I think at that stage we were thinking that maybe it was going to take out a certain randomness, but it seems to have swung back the other way of introducing more the weirdness of the circumstances. But yeah, I mean, Greg is probably right. I think maybe that's just because we're in the start of this season where, you know, teams are still readjusting after the most curious sort of pre-season in history, and it's just taking a bit more time to bed back in.
I also saw a table of the kind of behind closed doors football in a newspaper this weekend, and I think the top three were still Man City, Man United and Liverpool. So if you include the back end of last season, that's still the familiar names. Obviously, they've had less rest, a slightly more disruption in the kind of intervening period between the seasons. I think over a longer period, you'll still see the familiar names emerging.
So I take it that then, from a couple of you at least, it is not the most open season ever, just an open beginning.
Open start to
the season. Open start to the season.
Exactly. Well, as we like our stats, don't we? See in the paper this morning, most open start officially since 67-68, the last time that no teams were unbeaten after six games. So, but you know, I mean, we've seen some freak results. There's no two ways about that. But yeah, I think six games is early to be saying this will prove to be the most open ever.
I did find it interesting, though. You know, you look at the league table, and I think every team has an excuse for underperforming at the moment. I know some teams have had longer preparation than others, but they're all playing in a similar environment. So I still find it interesting the likes of Villa, even Everton, Crystal Palace or Southampton are up there at the moment playing decent stuff, and that the other big sides seem to be the ones who have been more impacted. That's what I find to be more interesting, and fair enough for a couple of teams who had, you know, European football and an extended time off to deal with. But what about the likes of Chelsea, for example, or Spurs? You know, they're not great. You know, there's a little bit of inconsistency, some good performances, some bad. Why do we think that is?
Is it just the difference between those teams that have, you know, the new signings have hit the ground running? You know, Everton, we've seen it with, well, obviously until this weekend, we've seen it with, you know, James Rodriguez, among others, and the way that they, you know, new signings have sort of bedded in beautifully. And Chelsea, who are still a team who are exploring what their best 11 is. You know, Frank Lampard's trying to juggle, you know, it's an exciting range of players, but ultimately, you know, which players to pick in which formations, which positions, is something that could take months for him to establish. I mean, if you go through club by club, I think that's, you know, certainly as you start the season, it's, you know, that's going to be one of the deciding factors.
Maybe it's partly patience as well, because times are odd and difficult for many reasons, that clubs are not putting the pressure on the managers that they were. I don't feel that any of the managers, even though some of them are going through some really very demanding situations and getting a lot of stick, that I don't feel any of them are likely to be sacked imminently. It's as though the coaching staff are being told, you've got longer in which to fine tune and find make sure the team gel. And, you know, it's like Frank Lampard, for example, has a free pass to work out currently. His current plan of action seems to be, I'm going to work out how to defend. And he's allowed to do that without scoring a goal. Whereas if times were normal, there would be an outcry that Chelsea weren't trying to score a goal. I'm laughing because there's a dog barking and it's not mine.
He's our greatest fan.
No, but your ankles there, man.
Stanley the dog, possibly named after Stanley Matthews. I'll just throw that in because it's a football podcast. He wasn't really.
But does anyone agree that even though we might be critical of formations and tactics and individual managerial decisions and demeanours, no one really expects anyone to be sacked imminently. There does seem to be people who would normally be under a bit more pressure seem to be given time, and that means you get this open season, I think, because they're allowed to fail.
I think at the moment a point is being greeted not necessarily as a win, but almost like 2 points at the moment. You know, teams seem far more content with a draw and not losing a game than they were before, particularly the big clubs. You know, if you don't lose at the moment, it seems to be like fans, players, managers afterwards, everyone's just like, yeah, okay, you know, we didn't lose, so we're pleased with that, which I find odd, you know. And I guess it's a little bit what Gregor said, you know, there might be this underlying belief that things will turn out okay in the end, and we're just going to build into the season slowly, get our rhythm back, and then after January, you know, we'll put together 5, 6, 7, 8 wins in a row, and that'll be a season-defining run. But I do think it's a very open season, and I'm looking at which other clubs will build the consistency. You know, Leeds United fans, I'll give my apologies now. You know, it's not going to be as difficult as I thought it would be at the start of the season. You know, there are teams in there who are going to grab onto this a little bit more tightly than others. That's the thing that I find most intriguing, because I like NFL. I like American sport, for example. I was watching a series during the summer called Hard Knocks, and the LA Chargers head coach Anthony Lynn, the first Zoom call he had with his players before they came back to training in a totally new environment with testing and social distancing, you know, he said whoever could manage the situation off the field with coronavirus had the best chance of winning the title that year. You know, it was about the mindset, the ability to put up with the difficult time that they were going to face and a new environment. You know, that was more of his focus than on the field. He was like, you know, because our preparation for on the field very much will be defined by how we can cope with how procedures work off it. And I wonder whether some clubs are just coping better with the things going on off the field, including having no fans. And that's why it seems more open at the moment. And maybe those bigger clubs are the ones who currently aren't coping as well. Maybe they're more disrupted by what's going on off the pitch. Gregor, what do you think?
Yeah, there is no bigger disruption than no fans inside the stadium. And I agree, that's a good point. I heard Michael Appleton, the Lincoln manager, I can't believe we're still talking about Lincoln and Tom's not on the podcast. He was saying the same in different circumstances. I heard him on the radio on the way to a game at the weekend. He was saying exactly the same thing. It's about, you know, minimising the risk for the players and the disruption that they're going to have. So, but the biggest disruption is the fans. And I just wonder as well whether, you know, going to Anfield, going to the Etihad, going to the Emirates, all these places, it's not the same. It's not got the same kind of daunting sort of feel about it. It's now kind of a massive leveler in those terms. And people have tried to kind of approach this from so many different angles. Whether, you know, strikers are more relaxed in front of goal. And my personal thing is that I think defenders are just slightly less heightened by having no fans around them. It kind of, I've said this a few times, it always made me feel kind of a bit more naked on the pitch. It's like there's no one in support of you all around you. It almost helped you get your bearings as well. So there's so many little fine little details, and I think we're still kind of working out how it is affecting teams, but that is the biggest effect. It's the biggest change. And as I say, the bigger teams, the more vaunted clubs whose home records, you know, were something that they could rely upon. That's been, you know, that's changing.
But to pick up on what Gregor said then, I just wonder if, with no fans, come the 75th minute, you forget you're in a proper game and you start thinking in training games terms, because the ambiance is very much hearing what the coaches are saying from the touchline and that echoey silence. I wonder if it's harder to remember to stay completely concentrated for 95 minutes, as it turns out to be most of the time, when you haven't got someone on your back constantly, and whether that slightly affects defenders more because of the type of concentration they have. Because I think a lot of athletes will tell you they get through those moments when they're mentally dipping and physically dipping because they have that connection with the supporters and they want to react to that. But if you haven't got that oomph behind you and the reminder that this game matters, sometimes I think concentration dips.
Gregor, what do you think?
I agree, absolutely, yeah. It's really hard to explain. I've been going over this in my head over the last 24 hours. It's very hard to explain what a crowd gives you. It's kind of, apart from just as I said, sort of heightened senses and you know, more adrenaline and stuff, it's something about your bearings. It's like the stands feel closer. They feel nearer when there are people and there's kind of movement in them. And the noise as well is a kind of arousal. It's just, I think that a defence, you know, if you're looking at, there's going to be more mistakes or more kind of imbalance. I think a defender makes a mistake, it's going to be punished. If a striker makes a mistake, it's more important if a defender does so personally. So I think the effect is being seen more on defences.
I need to ask what sort of football fans you are now. Would you rather see the Premier League return to the sort of predictable nature of the big clubs that we've known and loved over the last 20 odd years? Or would you prefer this random nature to continue throughout the season? Anyone can win a game, a few more 7-2s, Alison, you never know. What would you choose?
Oh yeah, I'm into losing 7-2 every week. It's good for my metabolism. Keeps me slim. Yeah, sure. Let's go for it. I don't mind it being unpredictable if it's because of the tactics and the football and the flair. I'm just a bit suspicious of it being open because of the forces of COVID, to be honest. So I don't like it for that reason.
Matt?
Yeah, I think from my reaction to Project Big Picture, it told you all you need to know about my views on Big Six domination and the possibility of that basically being in perpetuity. I think, yeah, I take Alison's point that if it's COVID related, obviously it's... far from ideal, but this is probably one of the few uncertainties in the world we can embrace at the moment.
Unpredictability all day long. I still think, as unpredictable as it seems at the moment, we're going to see, even if Manchester City are have an awful season and they look like they're really disjointed at the moment, are we going to say they're not going to finish in the top three or four? No chance.
I was going to say, look at the table. I mean, if they win a game in hand, they're up to fifth. If Man United win a game in hand on the sum, they're up to around that. So,
Stop ruining it, Matt.
I know. Sorry to be a... all of our wonderful theory. I think we should still air our wonderful theories, but we should just keep them as theories for now, basically.
Well, you never know. Leicester City, obviously, they've won the Premier League title before, but they might be part of this unpredictable nature and continue their stride, although it's quite predictable, to be perfectly honest. Let's reflect on them and a little bit on Arsenal too. Jamie Vardy's goal means Leicester are handling the new normal pretty well, aren't they? They're up to fourth at the moment. But I wanted to talk about Arsenal more so. It's three defeats in four league games for Mikel Arteta, the Arsenal boss. Is the party over before it's begun then? Matt, you're at the Emirates. What did you make of the game?
Well, I thought that Arsenal actually, if you'd asked me at half-time, I was enjoying Arsenal's performance apart from, in the last 10 yards. I quite liked the way Arteta had them set up. I liked the sort of fluidity of the system where you suddenly had, Xhaka and was going from left midfield back into left back to allow Tierney to bomb on. The same on the right side to allow Bellerin to get forward, and it was And it was working to the point of, you know, then you had some arrowing great balls from David Luiz in particular that were getting to the fullbacks. And yeah, I thought the system was yeah, there was a focus to it. There was a clear plan to it. And it was, say, working up to the point where it got to, well, Lacazette on one occasion, most notable occasion. Aubameyang starting on the right was definitely, he didn't seem very comfortable there. Obviously, we've seen his sort of trademark runs in from the left, and that was one bit of it that wasn't clicking. But yeah, say if you'd asked me at halftime, I would have thought, okay, you know, there's a frustration, but there's also a plan here and a, you know, a pretty progressive one. It was second half where they basically started losing their way, and they almost just sort of ended up stumbling into this trap from Leicester, which clearly was frustrating them for 70 minutes, throw on Vardy and try and hit that, you know, hit on the break as they did in classic style. So, you know, if I was an Arsenal fan, I wouldn't be despairing. I would see where Arteta's trying to take this team, but like Arteta will be himself, I'll be asking some questions about the punch at the sharp end of it. And I'm not quite, I'm not 100% sure what the answer is, apart from getting Lacazette to miss the ball from 3 yards out.
Gregor, what did you think? I know you watch a bit of Arsenal. You know, there were periods where I thought Youri Tielemans in particular, Mendy as well from Leicester, were just given way too much time and space to turn, to dictate. And I didn't see a response to that from Mikel Arteta. And I know Partey was making his full Premier League debut, but and there will be some adjustment time there in terms of the midfield getting used to how he plays as well. But I didn't see it addressed by Mikel Arteta. And that was my only concern, because that was the only way they were going to lose the game. And in the end, it was.
Yeah, you know, I think, first of all, you have to give Leicester credit for that. I mean, it was the same against Manchester City. Tielemans playing a little bit deeper, where you can find a little bit more space and turn, and with one ball over the top, open up the defence. You know, that's clearly Leicester's plan, and it worked to a T. Although you have to say then, you know, I'll keep coming back to, you could see Arteta's blueprint, and you can see, you know, what he's trying to do with the team, but he's still playing Xhaka in a back three, or Luiz, and bringing on Mustafi. And for the goal, Mustafi turned and kind of ambled back in, and Jamie Vardy was, you know, the first ball was good, but it could have still been cut out. It could have been rectified, that, and Mustafi just let Vardy just hear through and have a very simple finish. So he's still got players that he has to rely upon that really he won't want playing for Arsenal in the next 6 to 12 months. So that's the first thing to say. Part of its personnel. But Arsenal have only scored 8 goals in 6 games as well. So there is something that's kind of a bit of a creativity, I don't know if block's the right word, but they're not firing in the same way that they have done in the past. You know, there's been talk about why Aubameyang is being played not in his best position when he's their best player. And you know, partly that may be fitting other players into the team, but I think honestly that Leicester deserve credit. I think Leicester deserve credit for the way they approached this game, and Arsenal, I don't know, something's not quite clicking in attack for them. Although, you know, as I said, they were very unfortunate not to score a goal. I'm not sure how Schmeichel was affected by Xhaka jumping out the way of the ball for that goal, personally. And as Matt alluded to, that cross from Tierney looked like he had an excellent first half, and he, you know, whipped in the ball for Lacazette, and I'm not sure how he didn't score there. So they were unfortunate not to score, but I wouldn't say it's worrying for Arsenal. I personally think that they have players in the team that they're not consistent enough. I've come back to that regularly. Luiz is not consistent enough. Xhaka, although he's improved greatly, and particularly under Arteta, is not consistent enough. I think the same is true of Ceballos as well. You know, I don't think he's consistent enough. So their squad's still not quite up to it.
I've been having an argument, Alison, with a mate who thinks Arsenal should be judged at the level of a Manchester United with similar expectations. I personally don't see it. I don't think a top six finish after eighth last season. Well, I'll ask you, is a top six finish for Arsenal this year good enough after eighth last season?
Well, I think it would, because I think Arteta is the ultimate example of what I was saying about managers just not being under pressure and being given more time than they normally would. I think that's tenfold at Arsenal. I think Arteta's just got free rein to say, if it takes me a year to get it right, he's going to be given a year and he will do it slowly and methodically. And if he moves up the table only by two places, I think he'll end up claiming that's reasonably successful. I mean, I'm being slightly tongue-in-cheek when I say that because they are Arsenal, but I just feel the fallout from the end of Wenger was so unpleasant and unpalatable and not the direction the club wanted to go in. They're ready to build slowly again. So, and I think probably because of that vibe, Arsenal will have a sense of solidity and might well end up hitting the heady heights of fifth, which I think would be fine. If you go through their personnel, they're a team that they're not all singing, all dancing to me. I don't look at them and think I expect great things. What greatness will come from Arsenal will come from how good a coach Arteta really is, because I think everybody behind the scenes at Arsenal think he's the man.
That said with tongue in cheek as well, Alison.
Well, I think, I would say, he wasn't flawless last night, but I think, everything I've seen from Gabriel makes him look like, he's someone that you're going to build a defence around quite confidently for some time. And Partey as well is obviously, he looks like the type of midfield, exactly the type of midfield player they've needed. So if you're looking at those as sort of two signature signings, if I was an Arsenal fan, I'd undoubtedly take some comfort from them as well. But I think Greg is right that, those are steps in the right direction. But then when you're throwing on Mustafi in those situations, you've got your head in your hands waiting for the error to come, basically.
You look at what other options do they have? Pepe came on. Pepe really has been so hit and miss. Willian's injured. So
wait. When was the hit? I missed that.
That was the odd hit, There's not a free kick once, anyway. Willian's injured, so yeah, he would be a strong addition for them. Nketiah, again, potential. Who else is there? Reece Nelson, potential. There's not their squad is thin, and I think he's already drawn improvement from this squad, and you've seen his sort of impact on the squad. I feel like I'm a kind of I'm champion Arteta every turn here. I don't mean to. I just feel that you can't see what he's doing, and there are going to be, kind of blips in this because the squad is still not anywhere near what Arsenal should be.
Another tough couple of games coming for Arsenal, though. Well, I should say Manchester United next. They've got Villa, they've got Leeds, who are doing well at the moment. Wolves after that. I mean, God forbid a bad run for Arsenal, but would that mean anything? Would that change anything?
I refer you to my previous answer. No, because Arteta ridiculously, I think Arteta is currently regarded as the most progressive coach in the Premier League. He's the one with most room to improve, the one we expect big things from. And he is, week on week, you look at Arsenal and you see something different. I bet, Matt, when you went to the game, you did not think you would come out of that talking about the way the defence went from a back five to a back three to a back four and the movement of everybody involved. I mean, that takes a lot of coaching, and you need to be confident that you're able to mess around like that, aren't you?
No, I doubt. I mean, I was there for the opening game of the season at Fulham, and they were doing a different version of that sort of fluidity with Tierney sort of fanning out as from a left-sided centre-back. But, I mean, just to throw a brick in the pond, how about, there's the other guy in the other dugout, Brendan Rodgers, Arsenal. He would have jumped at moving there from Celtic. He would have been on any sensible shortlist for me. I'm not saying that means Arteta is the bad choice, but Brendan Rodgers would have been a very credible choice for that job. So, Arteta's not going to be under pressure anytime soon. That's just not going to happen. But you know, I would have thought Brendan Rodgers is exactly the type of manager that might be next cab off the rank. I'm sure Alisson would agree with me.
Let's quickly give Leicester a wee bit more credit too, though. I think, you know, they were without Soyuncu, Pereira still out, and Didi, but three big players for them there. Fofana looks has come in. He looks like the latest emerging star for them. They are a club that are run well, and they have been for a number of years now, and that they're kind of seeing the fruits of it with a, you know, a very good coach as well. So, I think Leicester are going to be the team to kind of again to threaten to break into the big six again this season.
I was going to say Fofana, but having been there last night, I thought Fofana was the player that I was sort of, you know, if I walked away going any player as, you know, thought he was decent before, but I thought just sort of was on a different level than than I'd previously seen. I thought he as Greg said, he looked like he's really going to be a force, and they muddled through. I mean, you know, Harvey Barnes up front in the first half was one of those experiments that, you know, never looked like working. But as Gregor says, they were short of a few options. They'd played in Europe in midweek as well, obviously, and I thought at least they came with a plan. It was a scruffy plan, but it turned out to work very well.
Well, I mean, I would like to give Rodgers credit for the fact that after that quite horrible defeat to West Ham, Rodgers said, "We rushed the game." And I think, he did the exact opposite against Arsenal. They just were very defensive, very solid, the opposite of rushing, and just bided their time, so that when Vardy came on, they could rush with effect and take Arsenal a little bit by surprise. So it's good when a manager identifies what went horribly wrong and then does the exact opposite. I don't think you can lurch from tactic to tactic like that through a season and expect to finish in the top three, for example. But I think it's good. It was good to see that him identify that sometimes all the things we love about Leicester is the pace and the counter-attack and that sort of free-flowing joie de vivre that they have. It looks like it's effortless, but sometimes they go too far and they can be picked off. So he reined it in and it worked. Although, you know, we shouldn't be going on about a wonderful Leicester, because they were very lucky that the Arsenal goal was disallowed. It should not have been disallowed. So that would have made a difference, wouldn't it?
Gregor, a final point?
I was just going to say, it felt like a very cerebral affair, didn't it? There seemed to be cutting to managers in the dugouts, kind of poring over the iPads that they all have fixed to the side of the dugouts now and figuring out the tactics. And the two managers and their coaching staff were having a battle, a bit of a ding-dong, and it's Brendan Rodgers who came out on top.
Listen, each and every week, this is a very cerebral affair, the Game podcast. It feels like a managerial special as well. We're still going to talk about what a difference 365 days makes for Southampton. We'll also talk about some choice words from the Bolton boss, Ian Evatt. But a reminder, to enjoy more of our award-winning sports journalism, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times today, and you will get 1 month free. Go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So let's talk about the difference that a year can make. A year ago, Southampton beaten 9-0 at home by Leicester. That was their biggest defeat of all time in any competition. They then lost their next three games, but the club decided to stick by the manager, Ralf Hasenhüttl, and they've won a very respectable 16 of 34 Premier League games since that 9-0 rout. Alison, this is a lesson, isn't it, in standing by your manager?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the cynic in me thinks they probably stood by him because they didn't have anybody lined up that was quite right. And that has Southampton have tried to make that their model over the last sort of 6 years or so, that they don't sack without knowing exactly where they're going. I think they invested a lot in the Hasenhüttl way. And I think also the players would have canvassed the players, and the players would have said, no, we think we can get through this. If he'd been a different sort of character, I think he would have lost his job. But I think sometimes a sort of strength of personality can override an outcome, because Hasenhüttl is such a relentless, meticulous, intense, attention to detail sort of figure. I know all managers are to a degree, but he is particularly so. And you only have to go to a game in lockdown where he's the manager to realise that. He is unlike any other coach. I would say the polar opposites are Rodgers, who is your iPad manager and quite quiet and leaves the shouting to Schmeichel. And then Hasenhüttl does not shut up. He goes at them. And he's like that in training. He's like that all the time. He wants everything to be exactly as he wants it to be. He's relentless. And you can see that now are transmitted into the style of play they have, which is they don't have time to. He doesn't want them to think. He wants them to do. So it's one touch. Don't loiter on it, ball. Just do it. And lots of praise when you do it right, and lots of yelling expletives when they do it wrong. So if the players buy into it, that's the crucial thing, isn't it? I mean, he'd be out of town completely if the players were, you know, going on strike in the way that players do sometimes. They just engineer it that a manager has to go because they're not responding to what he wants. But they like it and they're buying into it. And it's not all the time you see it, but there's been enough of seeing Southampton click really quite beautifully. One touch, ping, ping, ping. And players having confidence to dribble and to have vision. That, yeah, well done Southampton for canvassing, making sure everyone was on board and going for it. It's a nice story, actually.
Henry Winter was clearly struck by Hasenhüttl's touchline antics as well, because he seemed to fit in go Danny into his match report several times today, obviously towards Danny Ings. And obviously he seems to be someone who is benefiting from being able to be heard on the touchline more, I would suggest. Just looking at Southampton's team as well, all those words, they are relentless. They're kind of unflashy. They're efficient, functional, those kind of words. They're not really, you know, Danny Ings is a star, but Che Adams alongside him works tirelessly. That is becoming a really good partnership. Romeo and Ward-Prowse in midfield, you know, they're pretty kind of diligent, hard-working players. Ward-Prowse has got a lovely right foot, but, you know, creative? Not so sure. Redmond, obviously, on his day is a real threat as a winger. Armstrong's another one. He's kind of, you know, very hard working, talented player. But you know, they're not, throughout the team, it's just they're very kind of functional, know the relationships all over the pitch, and I think that does reflect Hasenhüttl and what he wants. And you know, he's drilled in a system, a style of play that has become very, very hard to play against. And I think Matt may make the point now that since that defeat against Leicester, they've won the same amount of points as Leicester in the league. Is that right?
Yeah, they've got the same record. I spoke to Ryan Bertrand last week because it was it's probably not the most obvious anniversary that a player would want to talk about, the 9-0, but he was surprisingly open to it, because he said that, you know, he defined the sort of Hasenhüttl regime as one of learning. He says it's, you know, they're you know, I mean, clearly the manager, as we, you know, he brought it over from Leipzig where he had success there, but he has his own very clear vision. But he says, you know, the way Bertrand had it was that the players are engaged in a process of learning with him. And the 9-0, obviously, you're not going to get a bigger learning than that in the game. But he said that they still had a plan and a framework. It was tweaked, obviously, after that. He went changed defensive system. He put another striker up with Ings. There was, you know, the system was altered, but the intensity stayed the same, and actually found a system that played to that intensity better. So I think, you know, Bertrand talked about a place where, and Alisson's totally right about, hasn't, you know, the manager's sort of he's a guy who barks at them a lot, but I think engages with them a lot as well. He said it was, you know, it's not just a sort of sergeant major approach. It's something where they feel like they're developing, improving as players at the same time. So, and yeah, their record ever since that 9-0 would put them in, you know, top six, top seven form in any normal season.
Let's remember that they also were hammered 5-2 by Spurs on the opening day. So that wasn't exactly a great start to the season for them. And they responded with three wins from the next four. So, yeah, certainly good at responding from these setbacks as well.
Well, I think that's the thing. I mean, I think when Bertrand was saying, you know, the way they're playing with that aggression, when it goes wrong, it almost is almost as if it goes, you know, horribly wrong, because they are taking risks with that pressing and with that aggression. But at the same time, I guess if you do have confidence, you know, A, in the manager, B, in the framework that the manager's created, that when something like that happens, you know, you don't panic, you don't throw it out, you just work out where it went wrong on that day and try and learn and adapt.
Tony Cascarino in the Times points to the likes of Yannick Vestergaard and Jan Bednarek as the types of players that you just don't want to play against because they make things so difficult for you, despite individually maybe not being the most talented. But not to be disrespectful, it seems like they've got seven or eight players at Southampton in the starting 11 who will make things as difficult as possible for you, and some players that I suppose most of us as individuals wouldn't give that sort of high praise to, but as a collection of players, it does seem to work. They always seem to have a number of bodies flying at the goal anytime the ball goes near the final third. You know, they get forward in numbers and they take, as you've already mentioned, risks. Gregor, what do you think of the Southampton squad and the sum of the parts?
As I was saying, I think that, you know, you could include several players in that kind of description, and I think I've already mentioned, but Che Adams has been, his kind of emergence has been crucial for them. He is I would hate to play against him. He's a bustling presence, works so hard. And I think, you know, there's quite a few players in this team who've had an interesting route too. You know, he started at Ilkeston Town, I think, and went Sheffield United, Birmingham. You know, this is his opportunity in the Premier League. And there's a few players who've kind of, you know, they're certainly not players who've apart from Ings, who've played at the very, very top level. And I think they're striving to be the best they can in the Premier League. So it seems that seems to be the kind of ethos that Southampton have. And I think it's the way forward for them. They've been a club who've always brought players through from their academy and whatnot, but they've also recruited very well and they're reaping the benefits now.
I have to say, I mean, I think Che Adams as well is a sort of case in point of a bit of patience as well. I mean, I remember when he, you know, I've seen him a couple of times in the Championship. I think I saw him once score a hat-trick in about 5 minutes against QPR, and he just looked unstoppable, and a couple of other occasions as well. And when he moved up, I thought he's an absolute, you know, nailed on to make that leap. And as it turned out, Maupay did it sort of much better earlier, smoother at Brighton, and Che Adams he's taken a bit of time, and whether that's partly to do with confidence or opportunities or just the way, you know, linking up with Ings as he's just finding his feet. But yeah, a lesson in sometimes, you know, sometimes it can take a player a season to adjust. We tend to want to rush in and judge these guys as we do with coaches after 5 minutes.
When he arrived, he identified Højbjerg as crucial and made him captain and had him as the sort of leader on and off the pitch, and Højbjerg bought in completely to the Hasenhüttl way. And then Højbjerg made it clear that he didn't want to stay at Southampton. He was hoping to go to bigger things, but he was still at the club. So Hasenhüttl didn't always play him, took the armband off him. And what he did was it was like a slow withdrawal process. He let the team get used to Højbjerg slowly going. It wasn't a sudden thing. He sort of slowly drifted out of the picture. And Romeo has stepped up, I think, and taken that role on as someone who really has that grit and battle and intensity in midfield for them. And he was really good at the weekend. So I think if you want a sort of snapshot of Hasenhüttl beyond the guy who's barking and also, as you say, trying to make players better, I think he handled that very difficult situation really well. And if it had happened at a bigger club, I think much more would have been made of it. You know, if it had been Van Dijk at Liverpool wanting to go to Real Madrid for some bizarre reason, that would be the story every single day. But it sort of got lost a bit because Southampton are not overly fashionable and expected to light the world up. But it was important to them, and he navigated that superbly, I thought.
Yeah, fantastically. And look, if Ralf Hasenhüttl is an example of great management, then I wonder what you guys thought of the Bolton boss Ian Everett this weekend. A 1-1 draw with Cambridge United for his side. He then called out their on-loan 20-year-old goalkeeper Billy Crellin in his post-match interview, saying the keeper needed to man up. He said, "This is a man's game. 3 points are at stake and my team deserved to win." Gregor, from your playing experience, does that sound familiar to managers that you've worked with, and what sort of culture does that forge?
I can't remember many. This is why it's made kind of news. I can't remember many examples of managers calling out a player quite so explicitly like that. Rarely does it go down well in the changing room. I mean, he's since come out and kind of made a half apology, saying that I'm sorry if any offence was caused. But it's nothing that wasn't said in the changing room. Well, the changing room's response to that would be, why do you need to say it in public? You know, you've already told us. You've already told the goalkeeper. So, you know, it's always been a kind of unwritten rule that the manager should, if there's anything to be said, it's said inside the four walls of the changing room, and there's no need to say it publicly. You know, obviously, people are asked, and the goalkeeper's had a difficult time, apparently. And the manager can be asked, and he can say that, yeah, he's got to improve, but to say it in that manner and so kind of... I know Ian Everett a little bit. I've played against him, and I've been on a couple of courses with him towards the end of my career. And I feel like he was trying to be the kind of no-nonsense, old-school... And he even said again in his apology afterwards, the fans will know that what you see is what you get from me. So that is the kind of impression he's trying to give to the supporters and everyone listening there. But I would be surprised if it's already backfired. And I don't think this ever goes down well in the change room.
I don't know, Matt, Alison, what you think of talking about a young player like this, whether you're going to lose them, whether in your experience talking to managers you've heard something similar, and whether it worked out before?
The one that always jumps out with me is Mourinho in his first spell with Joe Cole. I remember, you know, there was a game when Joe Cole came in, did a match-winning performance, and, you know, we all sort of had the pieces ready of, you know, Joe Cole comes good, and Mourinho came in and slaughtered him. Basically just said, you know, apart from scoring the winning goal, you know, he did exactly the opposite of what I want, you know, and talked about the tracking back and the discipline. And now, in that instance, Mourinho had a plan, and it was, you know, again, I don't think it would have come came as a unpleasant surprise to Joe Cole, not necessarily a horrible shock. And I guess Mourinho would say that it was done with a big picture in mind of turning him into a different type of footballer, and one, you know, one that he felt the type of footballer he would want to thrive at Chelsea. So it's not, you know, it's not unprecedented to hear it. You know, big managers occasionally do have goes at players, but I think there was something about this one that was, A, as you say, the age of the keeper, B, you know, I mean, the phrase man up, you know, it's a sort of throwaway phrase, but one that you'd hope is being sort of, you know, slowly extinguished from the English language. It's sort of unhelpful in so sort of many ways. And yeah, there was just, as Gregor says, it felt like it was a manager trying to big himself up in the process as much as he was trying to, you know, help or improve a player or a team.
The phrase "man up" is really nasty now, because it implies so much more than just anything to do with football, doesn't it? It's like he's criticizing a player for being having problems, you know, in his personality, or maybe he's not loud enough in the dressing room. It's really out of order to use that phrase, because it does imply a lot more beyond pure football, which is really all you should be talking about. But weirdly, it's Mourinho that always pops into your head when you think about managers going too far, isn't it? And I was at Vicarage Road 4 years ago when United lost to Watford. And this is a weird one, because Mourinho came out and he was glowering. Obviously, they'd lost. That's fine. Managers who lose, they're allowed to be annoyed. But he just said, our left back is 25 metres away instead of 5, which does not sound like a particularly terrible criticism. But it was the way it was delivered. It was as though he could not bear to say Luke Shaw's name. This felt a bit off. It meant that everyone went away going, oh, he's talking, why is he talking about Luke Shaw like that? He really doesn't like him, does he? It was just, it felt like bullying. And I think Mourinho's has this tendency to have a go at a player, not just once, but twice, sometimes three times. And then it feels like bullying. I'm sure he thinks he's being very clever, but it's not a good image at all. But in terms of managers going too far, often it's with the media, actually, because we're there to ask questions. And it's interesting, occasionally managers just don't they're just not prepared for the question, which makes them the ones that look stupid, I think, or like bullies. I've seen Fergie rip to shreds a poor new reporter asking the question, and he was being brave. He was asking a question no one else dared to ask. And instead of looking at him and thinking, oh, well, you're being brave, Sonny, he just said, you know, who are you? Why are you here? And the poor guy just went completely red, and because it was just a horrible way of answering it. It was basically saying, you're not important enough for me to answer your question. So, yeah, and there's the famous ostrich comment. That's weird too. And and the only time it's happened to me, well, I've had lots of weird experiences, but I remember being at Stamford Bridge. Roy Keane brought Sunderland to Stamford Bridge and they lost. I think I just asked a question about, with hindsight, do you think you should have set them up that way, sort of question. And he looked at me and he said, why on earth are you asking that? With that intensity, can you imagine Roy Keane saying that to you? He was about a foot away from me. But I'll give him credit, but because I stood my ground and just asked a more aggressive question in response, he just paused and looked at me and thought, okay, you're being brave. I'll give you a really nice answer, which is what you want. Because I just don't understand why managers think it's clever to bully when they're in with the media, because everyone else will report it and no one's going to be on their side. So they really have to be better equipped. But fortunately, these examples are rare. They are rare. And it's interesting that both Matt and I immediately thought of Jose Mourinho, isn't it?
And it's just an insight into your character for those that listen to the podcast. More aggressive than Roy Keane is how we would all describe you as well. So you've absolutely nailed it there. Gregor, in your experience as a player, though, have you been called out by a manager so publicly? Did it affect you, if it had?
I was racking my brains, and I can remember once, yeah. I don't think I should remember. I should probably name the manager or club, but...
Why? He named you.
That's a good point, yeah. No, I'm not going to. But I was called out once. And, you know, players do notice. You know, they do. Obviously, this is blown up. You know, this is a League Two manager, and we're talking about it in the podcast here, and everyone has been talking about it this weekend. So this is blown up. But players, they do listen to what, you know, they'll read the local paper, or they'll watch the interview on the website, and, you know, anything on the TV, they listen to what is said. And if you're called out unnecessarily, which I felt I had been, then yeah, it makes you pretty angry. And I think usually your teammates will side with you too. You know, no matter what you've done, the goalkeeper's having a really hard time. This was not warranted. And it's hard to see what the benefit is apart from to Ian. he's making himself look like he's trying to project an image of himself. That is the only thing he's gained from this. And the goalkeeper has certainly not gained from it. So, yeah, it's happened. I was also, again, I don't think I should name the club or the time, but there was one time when we were facing a kind of relegation battle where our manager informed a newspaper that a group of players had been out on a night out, and it made the newspapers. He actually fed a story to the newspaper, again, to take the heat off himself because we were close to relegation. He tried to sort of sell the players down the river. So, you know, occasionally there can be some... More often than not, the manager's trying to make himself look better. That is at the root of it all here, you know.
Was your nickname the Barbarians?
The Barbarians?
Going out to dinner when you shouldn't.
Oh, yeah, I wasn't there, but it certainly wasn't a dinner.
I like it. He wasn't there. Yeah, I'm sure you weren't, Gregor. I'm sure you weren't. Take the heat off yourself as well. You're just like Ian Everett. listen, I really appreciate you talking to me, taking the time today as well. Thank you for listening to the Game Podcast. That's all we've got time for, but plenty to look forward to this week. Lots of European football. We'll be back on Thursday to look back at all of that. A reminder, though, if you want to subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times for more of the latest news from the world of football, go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame, and you'll get 1 month free.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.